And I have a great guest today who is going to help us in this amazing topic. Harmony Hensley has a background in vocational ministry as well as design and sales and marketing. I think she can do just about anything. And she's hilarious on Facebook if you ever just need a laugh during your day to get on and see what that is. But she is amazing. She has a dual degree in ministry leadership and biblical studies from Cincinnati Christian University. She has trained churches across the country and continues to consult to this day. Her passion is helping churches engage families that are affected by disability. So, Harmony, I'm going to ask you to kind of get us started and tell us your story. Tell us how you got started in special needs ministry and advocacy. It was a blessing to me to hear how you took this and made this a part of your life.
Well, thanks, Nancy. It was actually kind of an accidental thing. I would love to tell you that I was just born being a very compassionate individual, but I was a pretty average American high schooler. When I started as a freshman, I was a three-sport athlete, honor roll student, probably as close to being popular as I was ever going to be, and then I got sick. So that kind of put a halt to my social career that I thought I might have. And as a result, back a long time ago, you know, when I was in high school, I was classified as a special education student. By the time I was a senior, I had missed 272 days of school and was partially homebound. I've had a series of four surgeries to remove aggressive tumors from my neck, and one of the surgeries left my face paralyzed for a year. So I was the kid who went from being the All-American All-Star to I could barely walk to the bathroom without being short of breath from my severe asthma, and my face would twitch and I would drool on myself from some damage I had after a surgery. So suddenly my peers weren't the popular kids. My peers were the kids in the special ed class, and I knew Jesus at the time, and I just really felt like God was crushing my heart for those who are outsiders, and I learned firsthand what it's like to sit through an IEP meeting and have people focus on what you cannot do rather than what you can do. And so been folks that I have a very special place for in my heart. So that's how I got into it.
I mean, it just brings tears to my eyes to hear you talk because, you know, I'm on the same side of disability ministry than you are. I'm a participant through my son, and to hear your words where you say, I've been in the meetings where people talk about what you cannot do. I've seen it from that side, and to have you take that and turn it for advocacy and to be the voice for so many people who may not be able to speak for themselves and to yell out loudly, but here's what we can do. I just know that what you have to say today is going to be such a blessing, especially as we talk about training. We've had two other shows, and all of these shows have taken what a lot of people have said is an unconventional approach to how we train. We kind of have this idea that because this is such a serious topic that we need to have very serious and clinical models. And all three of my guests on the show have said, well, not really. And you've been a part of training for so long in so many diverse environments that I'm so excited to talk about some of the universal principles for training that you and I shared on the phone previously. And one of the parts of one of our conversations dealt with how we equip ourselves to know exactly what to train people for. And I have quotes that are perfectly useless on the radio that I just made with my fingers. The only way we know what to train for is actually by knowing the people we minister to. And that's part of the reason why your story means so much to me is you know from being the person yourself what you could do, that you had limitations, but what your limitations did not include. But in other words, let's you and I start our conversation today with how we train volunteers to get that good information and how we train ourselves as ministry staff on how to get information from parents and caregivers so we know their limitations, but also their gifts and abilities. How do we get started on that? You talked to me about a few ways, and I love the way you said it, that we can set the table for parents to be forthcoming and be more likely to give us information that helps us be able to serve a child. What are some of those ways that we can promote an environment for safe sharing?
That's such a great question and one that I love to talk about. I could talk about this for days. You know, especially with the holidays coming up, when you think about Thanksgiving, you think about, you know, hospitality, and you want to create a safe space where people feel comfortable and they can come and share a meal and, you know, forget about what time it is. And really, that's one thing that we should be thinking of all the time. That shouldn't be just a holiday mindset, but it should really be the way that we as Christ followers look at all the people around us. And so first we have to look at our environment and figure out ways that we can set the table for parents to be forthcoming and want to share information with us. If we have created such a busy transactional environment where, you know, here, print your sticker, put this on your kid, take your kid here and go, we haven't allowed mom or dad any space emotionally or physically to be able to share information about their child, nor have we made it feel like a safe place where we want to know about your child. I know I take my little guy, my little boy is a typical two-year-old, but he's my world. And when I dropped him off at Sunday school, I love that they have learned his name and they ask me how his week has been and how they can help support him from the hour. My son doesn't even have any special needs. That's really a ministry approach we should have for everyone. So one of the things I love about Disabilities Ministry is that we can really lead up and show the rest of the church what it looks like to really include people. So we want to create safe places for parents to be able to share that really, really precious information. It's a lot for a mom to trust you to say, you know what, my child struggles with transitions, or my kid's not perfect. So we want to make sure that you've created a relational environment where you're very warm and welcoming, where you're very positive-based, asking about, you know, what are some things you can tell us about your son or daughter for the hour that we can make them more comfortable? What's their favorite toy, their favorite friend at school, things like that. That has nothing to do with their disability, but it has everything to do with their personality. And when we build relationships with people, when you have a relationship with someone, it feels safe. And it feels like a place where maybe they should share a little bit more about themselves. And the more they share about themselves and their child, the more prepared you're going to be able to care for that child, and the better ambassador you're going to be in ministry to be able to train volunteers how to care for that child. So I hope that makes sense. But it really is about building your relationships.
Absolutely. And that was echoed in the words of Amy Kendall and of Rebecca Hamilton as well. It's a very relational thing. And when we take this, and we make it so clinical because of the subject matter, we miss the person, and we miss their gift and their personality. What a great word that you used. Their unique, God-given personality that will come out when we get to know them. And I thank you so much for saying that up front. It's setting a table. It's that warm welcome that we give. And it is so difficult at a welcome center. You know, you're putting a sticker, you know, on someone and getting all that taken care of. But for us to stop and pace ourselves and realize that Christ's message was very relational. Thank you so much for saying that so eloquently. Next, you just nailed this on our phone conversation, and I'm so excited to get to talk about this thing that has been important to me as a special needs mom. I like to say that in the absence of best practices, something's going to fill the void. And one of the most difficult pieces of communicating with parents, training ministry leaders and volunteers and that welcome staff, how to encourage and edify them, especially in the midst of something that may be a very difficult disability, and you're trying to get around that, but you're trying to encourage the parents at the same time, and knowing how to talk with them and not talk around the issue, but speak through it. And many times, those of us on the ministry side with loving hearts and just the very best of intentions don't know what to say. And I have had some people that what they meant to say was very, very wonderful, but what came out really didn't edify me as a parent very much. And you and I commiserated about something that you call Christian scripting, which is also a brilliant way to phrase it. Can you tell us what that is and how you and I have experienced it to be harmful, and maybe give us a better solution for what to say, because it's so important to know what not to say, even as much as what we can say for parents.
Yeah, you know, sometimes silence really is golden. I think a lot of times when Christians are in an uncomfortable situation, you go to what you know, and that's what I call Christian scripting. And so I have unfortunately witnessed and been on the receiving end a lot of times of those things where if someone has shared something difficult with you, then, you know, the other person goes off on, well, God won't give you more than you can't handle. And when God closes one door, he opens a window, and, you know, we've all heard them. It's on, you know, 500,000 church plans that we all kind of tease about. But
yes.
The reality is those things are often very hurtful. You know, I myself have struggled with clinical depression my entire life, and I had a well-meaning Christian friend once who said, you know, honey, if you just had more faith and prayed more and gave it to God, then you'd feel better. And I know that that person meant well, because I know her heart, but what she was communicating to me was that I was not handling my depression right, and that it was a reflection on my relationship with the Lord and the way that I viewed myself in the eyes of the Lord. And that was an unfair and inaccurate thing for her to say, but she was uncomfortable, and she didn't know what else to say. And we do that a lot with parents. And sometimes I've even, you know, to the other end of the spectrum, some of those comments were meant to be really comforting. I've also heard people say, well, you know, it's probably sin to the father if that's how this sort of thing happens.
Yes.
Goodness gracious, if I had a dollar for every family that has been crushed by those words, we could fund tons of ministry, sadly. So my advice to people is if you don't know what to say, it's okay to say, you know, I'm really at a loss. I'm not sure how to say what to say right now, but what can I do to encourage you? It is okay. It is completely okay to ask a person how to encourage them. What do you need from us right now? What is a practical way that we can show you God's love? It might just be, you know what, do you need someone to just talk to you? Can I buy you a cup of coffee and you can just tell me the whole mess that you're going through? I may not have answers, but I can certainly listen. And the gift of listening is often far better than anything that we could spout off that we heard from Sunday school and maybe are quoting out of context. So I just caution Christians to just be very careful with our words. And you don't always have to fill the silence with something to say. Sometimes you fill the silence by allowing them to speak to you. So allowing the parents to have a safe place to be a sounding board.
Again, safe places. It's almost like there's a trinity of people here that need safe places. The child needs a safe place. The parents need a safe place. And you mentioned something so wonderful in relation to training that volunteers also need
absolutely
a safe place to ask questions, sometimes their ministry staff, sometimes of their team. Can you talk about how you have accommodated the different learning styles and personalities of volunteers by providing them that they knew there was going to be a safe place so that even if they did not feel equipped in a moment, they knew they could come back and be in that safe place with you? How have you done that, honey?
Yes. I call this is so funny, we call it Switzerland moments, you know, because Switzerland historically was known for being a neutral zone and it was a safe place. So I have always trained my volunteers to know if you need a minute, or maybe you have not processed all of your thoughts through the redeeming blood of Jesus, I'm your safe place. I am your Switzerland. You can come to me. And it doesn't have to come out pretty or politically correct or, you know, your people first language doesn't have to be in line. Just tell me what you're feeling. Tell me how frustrated you are because I know your heart and I know that behind that frustration is someone who loves the Lord and loves these families and wants to figure it out. So I communicate to them regularly that it's okay to get mad. It's okay to get frustrated. It's okay to be concerned. I know a lot of us who have been in disabilities ministry for a long time, we have some war stories. You know, we've been hit, spit on, peed on. You know, we've been in screaming matches or on the receiving end of a screaming match. We've had a parent who has gotten really upset with us, either reasonably so or not. It's hard. I don't pretend to say that ministry is easy. Anyone who tells you that ministry is easy is lying to you, unfortunately. But it is all about, again, building those relationships with volunteers to say, I am not going to send you anywhere that I'm personally not willing to go. So I am your ally in this. We are on the same team. So tell me how things went. I also am a huge fan of creating intentional space on a regular basis for debriefing every week, even if it's just a couple moments to say, hey, how did it go this morning? Was everything okay with Jill? Yeah, and it might be, yeah, everything was great. Or it might be, you know what? No, it wasn't. She wasn't focused, and the craft was horrible, and I didn't know what to do. Okay, let's unpack that. You give them permission to speak with what's scaring them, what's made them uncomfortable. And then, you know, the Bible tells us where there's no wisdom, people will perish. So figure out the gaps, the missing knowledge, and let's fill that in, because I don't want my people to perish. I want my team to flourish. So I give them permission to say, I don't know what I need. I need something else. And then we work together to figure it out. I have some volunteers who will love nothing more to sit through an 8-hour training and hear from a bunch of speakers on disability. I have other folks who, that is not their learning style. They're not auditory processors. They're much more visual and hands-on, so they would be far more suited to do a one-on-one thing. So I really am a proponent of there is no such thing as one-size-fits-all ministry training. You really have to create a bunch of different opportunities for people to get the information that they need and create environments on a recurring basis in different kinds of environments for them to get the information they want. You can have a newsletter with nice little blurbs. You can have a blog where you share different information. You can have a parents' night where parents come in and share their wisdom, which is often far more beneficial than anything I could ever come up with. And then volunteers feel like they're really a part of something, not just a minion I'm going to check this box off for the week because it's given for an hour and serve. We want them to feel like owners of ministry.
Yes, and then I really think that also speaks so much to volunteer retention. When they can have had a place to unpack that day, good or bad, with someone before they leave the campus of the church, I don't think they leave feeling as frustrated and devastated. It still happens, and you may not give them an answer before they get in their car, but they've been able to voice it, and then they don't internalize it, and it's not about them and their inability to meet a child's need. And volunteer retention is an issue across the board because people lead busy lives, and if they feel they're not being successful at something, that's just kind of one more motivator to maybe leave that ministry off. So
I was just going to say a quick soundbite. I have told pastors all over the country, relationships cause retention.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. So for anybody listening saying that's an issue, retention, just tiny, tiny thing, that little mustard seed of a strategy, of a time to unpack, that may make a huge difference to a listener today who's saying, you know what, if that volunteer just had a chance to talk about this, maybe we can make a little bit of progress. Incredible. I always need to bring up, so many of our listeners are from just different kinds of churches. I mean, big churches, small churches, across denominations. So I always try to address the issue of different churches needing different training resources and different training styles. And you just had a great analogy about the merits of large churches and smaller churches and how they're really both kind of equipped to do this kind of ministry. Can you share that analogy and point out the merits of both kinds of churches and what they have to offer in training for special needs ministry?
Sure. I have a background of I've been a volunteer with support from a staff member. I've been a volunteer without support from a staff member. I've been on staff at a large church with a large budget and lots of resources. And I've also been, in a place where we didn't have resources. So I really do speak a lot of dialects there. And the metaphor that I always use for folks is that we have to remember that in the body of Christ, there are different kinds of churches. And some churches are cruise ships and some are speedboats. One is not better than the other. But sometimes when you get into a large church environment, you've got a cruise ship. There's all kinds of internal systems and programs and offerings, and there's very specific ways that things need to happen in order for everything on the cruise ship, pardon using that name, remains in harmony. There's a system.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have a speedboat, right? A speedboat is stealthy and small and responsive, and they can get into places that the cruise ship could never go. They can go into waters that the cruise ship would obviously have a huge problem with. So just remembering that sometimes we have to understand, am I a cruise ship or am I a speedboat? And so where there's a church that maybe has tons of resources, they might be able to offer a certain level of services, but the reality is there are some families, they could never, ever be a part of a cruise ship church. It's too big. It's too overstimulating. It's just not right for their family, but they would do so well with a speedboat who could come to meet them where they are and understand what different unique challenges that they face. And so understanding that you can use those things as an attribute instead of saying big church versus small church, that sounds like, oh gosh, my church isn't as good or my church is better, and I don't think that's God's heart for his body at all. So we just have to figure out what are our unique gifts that our church has to offer. And often, smaller to mid-sized churches are better suited to be able to do this ministry than some of the large churches are because they don't have as much red tape and as many specified systems and programs in place that require years and years and lots of staff to set up. So it's just understanding that really, no matter what size church you're at, you can start with just one family. Usually people, I wish that I could say I've had people call me and say, hey, our church doesn't, you know, anyone with disability and we would like to start this ministry. That I've never gotten that phone call. I would love to, but I haven't. Usually it's because they say, well, there's this kid. So start with this kid. Whether you're on the cruise ship or the speedboat, start with this kid and let's figure out what we can do to help this kid and a vital part of the body of Christ and have something to offer. Let's figure out how we can get them engaged in our community. What does that look like? Does it look like getting some sound-canceling headphones that they get at the welcome desk so that they're not, you know, having issues with sensory integration? Does it look like finding them a one-on-one buddy? Does it look like getting them take-home sheets that they can work through because they have some issues with learning how to read? It doesn't always have to be a huge program.
Yes. Oh, wonderful. Wonderful, wonderful stuff. And it's so refreshing to hear three different perspectives on training, and all of you come back to this relational idea and this relational model. It has warmed and encouraged me so much. And you said, you know, regardless of size, everyone has something they can offer for some of these families. And we talked about on the phone a few universal principles for meaningful training. As you are seeking to train volunteers, regardless of the size of your church, there are some things that you can address for consideration in training their volunteers. What are a few of those questions that can be asked when you're considering training that fit churches of all sizes? And then why do you think that these are universal principles of training as we go through these things?
Yeah. Well, now everyone's about to be completely unimpressed because these questions that I ask are really quite simple. No matter what church you're at, what size it is, what the culture is, what the demographics are, the first question that we should always ask is, what would show the extravagant love of God to the person that we're serving? So if it's the child with a disability, what would show the extravagant love of God to this child who has autism? And so that means learning a little bit. You know, I literally would take my team members to, let's get some role play for a minute. Let's imagine that we've got some sensory integration stuff, and we don't like the sound of cars outside if your church is close to the street, or we get really anxious in large spaces. What are some different things we can do? And we would literally put it on the whiteboard and just start. It's a brainstorming session, so there are no wrong answers. So what are some ways that we can, you know, make this child feel more comfortable? We ask, what would show the extravagant love of God to the parents? Imagine the anxiety that this mom or dad might have taking their child to a new place with new people in a new environment where they just don't know what to expect. What are some things we can do to make them feel loved and supported? What would show the extravagant love of God to the volunteer? How would that volunteer feel like they are more than prepared to love on this child for an hour? What can we do to make that happen? What would show the extravagant love of God to the community? You know, the reality is, if you do this well, these families are very tight-knit, and before you know it, the community is going to start to buzz about that church that really reached out and served this family who was affected by disability. And then you can look even at looking at what would vendors in the area. You know, we live in a country where people like to donate and be a part of things, and so how can we reach out to those folks and join the arms so that we can really model community? And the interesting thing is, as you start to see those answers, you'll see a pattern. And one of the examples that I use is a communication key, which you can actually download it off the Humanistry toolbox. But I was in a meeting once with a gentleman who was one of my best volunteers. He had zero background working with people with disabilities. He was a man who's a general in the Air Force, and he was fantastic at really thinking through things systematically. And his number one hiccup as a volunteer was his greatest fear would be that there would be a child who would come in who wasn't able to communicate to him what he needs, because communication is very important in the military, or anywhere for that matter. So I said, okay, well, if that wasn't an issue, you know, would you feel better? He said, well, yeah, but tell me how it's not an issue. So I worked with a person who is a speech pathologist, and we created what we call communication keys, and it's a series of board maker symbols that we put on every single volunteer's name badge. So that was actually created to make a volunteer feel comfortable, but imagine how that child would feel when they come in and they see a sea of faces who have these very familiar icons on there, and there's a map maybe adapted for your building that has these icons. Imagine how supported they would feel. Or the parent, if you walk into this new place where you don't know anyone, and oh my goodness, they have board maker stuff here, obviously they've done their homework to try and reach out to my child. As a professional in the community, you know, it's unfortunately the reality is the church is not usually known for setting the bar for how things are done, which is backward. You know, imagine mm-hmm. what they would say, gosh, my pediatrician's office could do that. We don't even do that, you know. So suddenly, by asking this universal question of how to show the extravagant love of God to people, you're going to have a solid system for caring for folks.
Oh, that is just amazing. And there is no shame in that being so simple and so wonderful, because that really is what this is all about. It's really at the heart. And sometimes we let all of these questions and fears and anxieties rise up in the face, and they obscure the mission of God for us, which was to tell every family and every child that they have been made in His image. Wonderfully and beautifully, and that they're to be a member of this body of Christ. When we let these issues and fears, they're no less real, but when we let them rise and stand up so high that they obscure what can be the simplest question, how do we tell them that God loves them? How do we show them that God loves them? And that's just something that you can sit down one-on-one with a volunteer and do. You can sit down with a team. It's a great strategy for a planning session as you go along, and I just encourage all of our listeners that you guys write that down. You know, you can do like I do. You can write a lipstick on your mirror, put it on a post-it on your computer, have it in your car, have that in front of you in so many places that it becomes what rises up in the face of fear. It becomes what rises up in the face of a question. And when that volunteer comes to you, and what a great example of someone saying, communication is what I'm afraid of. And you can say, okay, you're afraid of communication. Our ultimate goal is showing the extravagant love of God. What's the connection between those two? Problem solved. Problem solved. No less of a problem, but a solution for it. Because this question has to do with a God that is a God of solutions. That just is. And this can be such an overwhelming project. You shared that your grandmother using old expressions I think still teaches today, and I giggled over it over the phone. I was close to my grandmother, too. Tell us what that expression is and how you think it can help churches as they begin a ministry like this in their church.
Yes, my grandma is hilarious. But she used to always say, how do you eat an elephant? And she would answer, well, one bite at a time, because it sounds completely overwhelming and ridiculous. And so I always tell folks, you know, let's figure this out just one step at a time. I'm not asking pastors, you know, especially I've been at conferences where they have sat through hours and hours and hours of great information, and it's all very good information, but the reality is they're going to go home and they still have to run their ministry, let alone trying to figure out how they're going to integrate all this new information. And so I always tell people, just pick one thing. I'm not asking you to completely overhaul everything. Let's start with one thing and let it snowball and build over time there. And that's how you get systemic, organic inclusion that is sustainable. That's what we want. Mm-hmm. We don't want a flash in the pan. You come in, you put all this effort in, and then boom, you had nobody buy in, and so it's just going to wither, and then nobody's really going to be receptive to it if it comes in again. Versus if you build it slow and steady, one step at a time, you're going to have something that actually can start to change culture in your church and can actually become a pervasive part of just the overall ministry approach of the body that you serve with, and that is how you start to change the church.
And I think that's wonderful. I consulted with a church, it's been many years ago, that had some dedicated volunteers, and they were very good, but it was kind of a flash, and it didn't sustain. And there were several reasons for that. One of those was that those volunteers, which was a very small circle, knew what to do. But after they moved on, no one else was equipped to do it, and there wasn't this idea from the top down. But I really think it's best created when you do it the way you're proposing harmony, when you're talking about some universal questions and the extravagant love of God and why you do this. So before I forget, I want to encourage listeners, this is an excellent archive listen to share with your church leadership, because one of the things they may be afraid of if you're considering beginning this kind of ministry emphasis is, we'll never be able to train people for that. We'll never be able to get people to buy into that. People won't want to do it. It's going to cost a lot of extra money. We can't buy another wing for the building to be able to do this kind of ministry. This conversation with Harmony today dispels all of those huge fears in the light of some very simple relational principles. So if you're listening to this and saying, oh, this is fantastic, send this to your church leadership. Send this to someone who may have those fears rise up so that you can share this wisdom with them. Harmony, I've got one last question. I ask you that if you could share one more additional piece of training with them that we hadn't had a chance to mention. You talked about the use of training as actually an outreach tool, and you touched on it a little bit earlier about a way for community involvement. Can you unpack that idea for us and how you've seen that be helpful? Because something I hadn't even thought of. What's that extra piece of wisdom?
Yeah, well, you know, as we're starting to mind out how we're going to show the extravagant love of God to folks, we realize, again, there are gaps in wisdom. There are going to be things that my folks don't know fundamentally about how to serve this population. And the reality is, we in our very community, as your neighbor, a friend, the person across the street, the person down the hall from you, may have a master's degree in, you know, speech pathology or whatever. So part of what I have always loved is that a big tool in my ministry tool belt is building outside relationships with people who are out in the community already serving this population. Because then it's strategic from an outreach standpoint, not only to serve more families affected by disability, but the reality is that not every therapist or doctor or nurse or teacher or educator who interacts with these families sees Jesus yet. So it's an opportunity for us to reach out to yet another layer of individuals and say, hey, God cares about you. He cares about everybody. And so we would love if you would come and just share some of your wisdom with us so that we can do a better job of caring for the kids that you care about. And I can tell you, I have seen it in my own ministry. I've seen it in other people's ministries where time and again, I would have individuals from the disabilities services industry who honestly were very skeptical about me, my ministry, my motives, and they begrudgingly agreed to answer some of my questions. And very quickly the tide turned and they realized that for us this was about Jesus and this is about loving and valuing and honoring and equipping and engaging this population. And they were drawn to that just like the rest of us have been drawn to the gospel of who Jesus is. So just be mindful that you really have to think outside the box, and the box I'm referring to is the four walls of your church. So figure out who in the community you can reach out to. Maybe you're just buying them a cup of coffee. Maybe it's a special educator at a school that you know that you partner with and say, hey, can you just tell me a little bit about your world and what you do? And, you know, we're trying to learn more about how engaging we can engage our kids, and I'm wondering if maybe you could come and guest lecture for a little while on a Saturday morning training or that sort of thing. Invite them in. Create an environment where they feel like their skills are valued. You're going to end up gaining a whole other audience of people to share the gospel with.
Absolutely. What a great, great idea. You've got so many wonderful experiences that I know that you could share. And we may have listeners that are wanting to know more specific things about that last question or about anything else we've talked about today, or who maybe want to call you for a consult that are in your area. Can you give us some of your guest contact info, any places they can get in touch with you, with a website or Twitter or any way that people can get in touch with you if they wanted a consult?
Sure. I am on Facebook. I never turn a person down, so most of my friends on Facebook are people who I've met through teaching over the years, which has been a real blessing. It's just under Harmony Hensley. That's H-A-R-M-O-N-Y, Hensley, H-E-N-S-L-E-Y, or you can email me. That's hensley.harmony@gmail.com, and I'd be more than happy to answer any questions that I can. And I would just love to connect with anyone. This is what I'm passionate about, and mainly just would like to hear their stories.